speaker is Jim Rickenbacker, and he's going to talk on immigrant ships, migrations. A few years back, we had a discussion on the internet about immigrant ships and how they came and what routes they took and so forth. And Jim was so knowledgeable on that, and he even knew about all the prevailing winds and Gulf Stream and all that. I don't know if he's going to talk about that, but I just thought it was really interesting, so I asked him to make a talk out of it. So we'll have Jim speak. Jim Rickenbacker will speak about immigrant ships, migrations.
Well, Pam, you asked for it, and that's what you're going to get.
That was a good thing.
I'm going to talk about this morning immigrant paths. Basically, the German-Swiss migration to America in the 18th century, or really how they got from here all the way over to here. What was involved? Let's see where my clicker is. Okay, our German-Swiss came from two main areas. First area was southwestern Germany, marked here on the map, more or less centered on Heidelberg. Parts of present-day Rhineland Falls and Baden-Württemberg. The other area, the Switzerland area, was the German-speaking areas of Switzerland. This was essentially the north-central areas of Switzerland. Now, the reason for immigration, the reason they wanted to leave, is very simple. After the devastation of the 17th century wars, populations in these areas were rapidly growing, but there was limited land available for cultivation. So basically, people were beginning to get hungry. At the same time, the British were attempting to populate North America, and they were promising free land. Then you think about it, you know, if I am a German Swiss and I'm attempting to feed my family on something like 10 acres of land, split apart into maybe 15 little small parcels, somebody's promising me 50 acres of land for every person in my family, that just sounds like a dream come true. I really want to take advantage of that. Well, to take advantage of that, they had to get to America, and that's what we're going to talk about. Let's see. Make sure I got. Okay. We'll start off talking about the Swiss, and what I say will apply to the Germans also in part. In Switzerland, they really had two paths to get to a British port. They're going to have to get to a British port, pick up a British ship in order to immigrate to America. That was the British law. The first path, which was taken by only a few of the Swiss, but a few did take it, was by land through France, coming up this path all the way to Calais, across the English Channel, and then on to London. This was a fairly safe path to take. Travel through France was fairly safe, particularly if you could speak a little bit of French. It's 500 miles, marked from Bern to London. But you'd have to walk, or you'd have to hire somebody to, you know, give you some transport. But then, once you got to London, you could board your ship in London and off you'd go to America. The bulk of the immigrants, however, took the Rhine path. Down the Rhine. Basel is the upstream limit of navigation for the Rhine. Just above Basel, there are several falls which the Rhine takes, and so there's no way really to get a boat above Basel. This path is 520 miles from Basel down to Rotterdam. If you started in Germany, it was only about 340 miles. There was no walking. That was a big deal. There's no walking this. Once you got on board your barge, down the Rhine you'd go. Once you got to Rotterdam, you would board a British ship, which would then take you down the English Channel. You would make a stop in Cowes, the Isle of Wight, and that was your British port. You were already on a British ship, and off you'd go to America. Now let's look at the Rhine path. Okay, the Rhine River has been a trade route since Roman times. And trade on the Rhine, which is a fairly fast-flowing river, is mostly downstream. Downstream, it's powered by the current. Get a little help from oars and perhaps a small sail to keep you in the channel. It's fairly easy to go downstream all the way from Basel. There was a large trade in lumber on the Rhine, going downstream, because in Holland, in Rotterdam, Amsterdam, there was a large shipbuilding industry. But of course, Holland doesn't have very many forests. So we look up here between, say, Karlsruhe and Basel, we have the Black Forest. They have lots of lumber, but not a whole lot to do with it. So lumber, and in fact, barges and boats were quite cheap in this area. Lumber in Rotterdam and Holland was quite expensive. In fact, it was quite possible to purchase a barge in, say, Basel fairly cheaply, fill it up with either immigrants or even mill lumber, take it down to Rotterdam, and you could actually sell the barge off with the lumber in it at a profit. You could make money just on getting the boat down the river and selling it off for lumber. And that's exactly what happened. A lot of the barges that went down the river never came back, because coming back upstream was pretty tough. You've got to fight the current all the way. You're not going to make it with oars. You're not going to make it with a sail. You had to be towed. There was an official towpath that went up the Rhine as far as Karlsruhe, where you have horses that could pull the barge back upstream. You could get a barge up to 100 tons up to Karlsruhe. Past there, there were very few towpaths, and the few that were there would get washed out in the spring floods. So mostly it was manpower that would have to pull the barge all the way up to Basel. And if you can imagine that sort of thing, a bunch of men straining away trying to pull that barge upstream, it's pretty tough. But you could get a barge up to about 50 tons up to Basel. So the result of those facts, the upstream trade was a lot less than the downstream trade. Much of the traffic was downstream. Okay, so our Swiss German immigrants traveled downstream by barge, and I've got a picture here. It's the best picture I could find of a typical 17th, 18th century Rhine barge. And you can see we have a steersman, the captain, in the back steering with the oars. You've got some labor here. This labor might even be some of our immigrants, acting as oarsmen to help keep it in the current. It didn't take a lot of skill to pull the oars, and you could be trained fairly quickly. The skill was here, the man that had to guide the boat. You'd also likely have a small sail. If the wind was in the right direction, you could give the oarsmen a rest, and down the river you'd go. In this way, the barges from Basel usually could take somewhere on the order of 30 to 60 passengers. It pretty much filled them up. But by the time you got down to Germany, some larger barges were in use. And I've seen some records that said they had barges that would take as many as 200 passengers or more from Mannheim, which is right next to Heidelberg, take more than 200 passengers down the Rhine. The travel was not exactly safe. The Swiss current, a lot of submerged rocks in the Rhine. You have to be careful. You have to stick to the channel. Daylight travel only. So basically, you travel during daylight hours, make probably 50 miles. Then you tie up at night, eat, sleep, start off again the next morning. The biggest problem was the many governing units that you had to pass through as you went down the Rhine. And there were more than 30 administrative districts on the Rhine collecting totals of duties. Each one of these districts, you know, might cost you a half day, might cost you a day as you were going down. You have to wait on the customs collector, and he got to look at you, give you some static, take what he could, and finally let you go. None of them really wanted to keep these barges around. They wanted to get what they could out of them. But, you know, if you're a village or some administrative district, here's a barge of 200 immigrants with not very much. You don't want to keep them in town and have to feed them. You want to get them out of there. They generally pass them on through, but it still could take time. The other problem that they had is both French and German army units were often camping on the river or foraging along the river. And of course, army units at the time were wont to do exactly whatever they wanted to do. And if they decided to stop you, they might keep you for a day, they could keep you as long as they wanted to. Consequence was, if you really didn't have to deal with the administration, it probably only take 10 days, 2 weeks to go down the Rhine. But more than likely, and what usually happened, is it could take up to 6 weeks having to stop and deal with all the administration. Okay. Well, we've made it down the Rhine. When our German-Swiss immigrants got to Rotterdam, then the first thing they wanted to do was find a ship as soon as possible, because food and lodging are going to be expensive. Lots of travelers coming into Rotterdam trying to find passage to America. Not only food and lodging, but a lot of passengers, a lot of travelers coming through from all different areas. Lots of smallpox, cholera, etc. So disease was a problem. You could easily pick up disease in Rotterdam. You wanted to get the best ship possible. But that was dependent on just what immigrant ships were in port. When would they depart? The ship you wanted might not leave for several weeks, and that, you know, for that time you still got to stay in Rotterdam. Not a good deal. Do they have space? But the biggest constraint on you, the biggest constraint, it's always a constraint, how much money do you have? What can you afford? If you've got money, you can afford something pretty good. If you're going to have to invent yourself a passage, you might not be able to do as well. Let's look at what sort of choices you might have. I put up top the main choice, what you really wanted to sail on. The 18th century, this was known simply as a ship. But it was called a ship. You could be assured it had at least three masts. It was one of the largest of the commercial vessels. Generally had the most space. Would ride the easiest on the waves. Had the most experienced captains. Likely would have the best food, and likely would cost the most. A ship like this would take anywhere from 300 to 500, maybe 600 passengers. At 300 passengers, you'd probably have a very comfortable voyage, as comfort linen would be. 600 passengers, you'd probably be packed in like sardines. It might not be the best voyage. Okay, if you didn't get a ship, then your next choice would likely be a smaller two-masted brig or a snook. These would be a smaller vessel, something on the order of 100 to 200 passengers. And you might say, you know, what's the difference between a sprig and a snook. Well, it's only a technical difference. They're basically the same type of vessel. Depends on exactly how this back mast is mounted. If it's mounted directly to the main mast, you've got a brig. If it's mounted to a little auxiliary mast that's then attached to the main mast, that auxiliary mast is called a snow mast. That's what makes it a snow. So when you see in the records that they arrived on the snow brig, that just means it had a little extra stick back here holding that back sail. Well, if you didn't have any money at all, or you did it, you might have to fall down to the smallest of the vessels, a millimeter. Small, two-masted vessel, lateen sail. This is a Dutch-built ship. It was mostly used for coastal trade and in the Mediterranean. It was not really suitable, not the sort of ship you normally take on the North Atlantic Passage. But with the immigrants demanding passage, some of these vessels were pressed into service and did make the voyage. Okay, let's look at some of the details, some of the things you'd be faced with as a German-Swiss immigrant. First item would be space. And you hopefully could expect 25 square feet of space per adult passenger. This would normally be every passenger over about 12 years old. That was British law, that you had to provide 25 square feet of space per adult passenger. But the law was often ignored, particularly as they were packing these ships. The interesting thing is no space was allocated for children. Children had to share the adult space. What happens if you run out of space? Well, you got to pay as an adult for one of your children. Children and baggage, everything has got to go in that 25 square feet. 25 square feet is 6 feet by 4 feet. So imagine, traveling for several months. That's the space you're allocated. That's the only space you can count on as yours. If you had additional baggage, you could possibly take it if space was available, but you'd be charged for it. Food included. What you'd normally get, a normal ration, would be peas, good old peas porridge, and water. That's what you get daily. Maybe twice a week you get even salt pork or salt beef. That's your food. Anything else is only what you could bring with you and put in your baggage space. Your first stop would be cows in the Isle of Wight. And you could expect that the total time, travel time, Rotterdam to America, the total time you'd be on this vessel, be 60 to 100 days, 2 to 3 months. Depending, of course, on the wind and weather. And that's what we get into next. Sailing ships don't sail into the wind at all. Some of the more modern sailing ships can sail partially into the wind. Some can do a fairly good job coming close to into the wind, but not really. But square riggers, square rig sailing ships, do not sail into the wind. Some of them, the best they can do is go directly crosswind. Some of the Manila galleons couldn't even sail directly across wind. They could only basically sail downwind. So sailing ships are going to follow the wind. So to see how they came across the Atlantic, we have to look at what the winds are like in the Atlantic. There are two major wind patterns that prevail in the North Atlantic. And the first is down at the bottom, within 10 latitudes of 10 degrees north to 28-25 degrees north, are the trade winds. These winds are quite predictable. They blow essentially all the time. They blow from east to west. They're known as the trade winds or the easterlies. very dependable. They move a little bit north in the summer, move a little bit further south in the winter. But basically, once you're in the trade winds, they're going to blow you to the west. Going up to the higher latitudes, say above 35 degrees north, we have the prevailing westerlies. These are not quite as steady as the trade winds. Sometimes they die down. Sometimes they blow a little harder. And particularly, in certain latitudes, they can be very strong, even stronger than the trade winds. If you've ever heard the term roaring 40s, that applies to latitudes of 40 degrees north to 49 degrees north, where these prevailing westerlies are particularly strong. They're going to blow you from east to west. Now, these winds generate signal. Oh, let me stop. Go back here. What's this little area in the middle? That's called the Bermuda Azores High. It's an area where, as you might expect, the winds are light, variable, often calm. Not a good place for a sailing ship. You really don't want to be there. You could get stuck. Now, this wind pattern generates similar circulating currents in the Atlantic Ocean, which are also quite predictable. And they're named after the landmasses they go by. We start up here with the Portugal Current. Coming down, it becomes the Canary Current. Coming on down and across, it becomes the North Equatorial Current. Comes up here as the Antilles Current. Comes up North America as the Gulf Stream. And then comes across the North Atlantic as the North Atlantic Drift. And the whole cycle starts all over again. These currents will add anywhere from 1 to 4 knots to your sailing speed. Because of these wind patterns, works better if I pointed at the screen. Because of the wind patterns, the route to America was going to look like this. You were starting out, you'd come out of the English Channel and then sail almost due south, coming down past Madeira, the Canary Islands, and on down below the Tropic of Cancer. Once you got well into the trade winds, then you would essentially follow the latitude directly across until you made your landfall in the Antilles, and then you come up the coast to Charleston. This follows the old sailor saying, which is basically sail south till the butter melts and turn west. That is the classic route from Europe to America. It was followed by Columbus. It's been followed by sailing ships for years and years and years. It's 6,500 miles, more or less. It's a long way, but the wind and current is with you. When ships left Charleston, they would come out, catch the Gulf Stream, and often they went ahead and made a stop in Philadelphia because it was fairly convenient. You know, it's on the way. Stop in Philadelphia, maybe drop off some extra passengers, take up extra back passengers, and then across to Europe. And they would do the same thing. They would come up, get into the prevailing westerlies, find their destination latitude, and then sail the latitude until they made landfall, usually southern England or Ireland, and then up the English Channel back to Cowes, London, or Rotterdam. Classic sail routes across the Atlantic, used for years and years and years. Okay, we've got to actually have an example of a passage that's important to Orangeburg. This is the trip of the Samuel, the ship Samuel, 1735, bringing first settlers for Orangeburg. We have an account of this voyage, our old friend Hans George Stricker. And in a letter back to Switzerland, George Stricker left us this account of the voyage of the Samuel. He left Rotterdam on the 20th of May, 295 passengers. As he tells us, they had steadily good wind and weather. It was not too crowded. They had plenty of food and water. In fact, he mentions, and there was no bodily want. Only two old people died. You know, 2 month voyage or so, only two old people died. That wasn't too bad. But 43 children. Can you imagine that? 43 children died on board with smallpox and were buried at sea. Smallpox got into the children in Holland. I guess they stayed in Rotterdam too long. And 43 of them died on the ship and were buried at sea. Smallpox was still on the ship when they arrived in Charleston, and some were quarantined. That's accounted for in the council journals. They arrived in Charleston on the 25th of July. These are, by the way, Gregorian dates, which is why they don't match up with what you see in the Charleston Gazette. They arrived with 250 passengers, the ones that were left, 66-day passage. If not for the 43 children dying of smallpox, it was about the best possible voyage you could have. You really couldn't have a better one unless you saved the children. Okay. Well, once our immigrants arrived in Charleston, they weren't through yet. They had to get to Orangeburg. Once again, our friend George Stricker tells us how they did it. He describes it as a 6-day journey. There were 250 immigrants. These 250 immigrants included about 160 women and children. They walked. The council provided them 18 horses for provisions. At least they gave them food. And as Stricker tells us, they marched for a distance of 52 German hours into the land. And 52 German hours is 130 miles. A German hour is almost exactly 2.5 miles. And it was basically a German hour was how far the German army was expected to march in an hour. They were expected to march 2.5 miles. We're pretty sure that they went by the Amelia Township, because while the council journal had suggested that they should settle in Orangeburg, the immigrants asked that they be allowed to look at Amelia and to choose which township they were going to settle in. And the council gave them permission, so they were allowed to do it. Their route was undoubtedly chosen to avoid the rivers and swamps. Now, we had a nice talk last night talking about swamps. It was one of the things that really impressed these Swiss immigrants. They were not used to such things. And when you think about it, if you have 160 women and children walking, you really want to avoid the swamps. You don't want to get them into the swamps. So I'm fairly sure that the route they took looked something like this. I suspect they were ferried across the Ashley River from Charleston because, boats were available and easy to make a crossing there. Then they came up the high ground between the Ashley and the Stonewall Rivers, sort of following the Ashley around up through present-day Ridgeville, between Four Holes Swamp and the Ashley River. Coming on up around Four Holes Swamp and hitting, what would be presently Highway 6 through Eutaw, Santee, Ellery, and on up into Avila. Then coming back down through St. Matthews to Orangeburg. As I marked it here on the map, that measures out 120 miles. adding a little bit of wandering around and easily hit Stricker's 130 miles. Stricker also tells us that conditions were bad. He says it was hot. There was no shelter, not on the trip, not when they arrived at Orangeburg. Stricker himself mentions that he slept in the open for 21 days. Bad water. Some almost died on the trip. In fact, some of the immigrants were severely disappointed with the wretched conditions. I mean, they were really hacked off with it. About 50 of them, including our George Stricker, returned to Charleston. And as soon as they could, they took passage for Philadelphia. They wanted to go to civilization. Luckily for us, the remainder stayed behind and became the first of our ancestors to settle in Orangeburg Township. And they were the start of Orangeburg Township. They're the reason that we're here today, and for them, we're severely grateful. Questions?
Back to your barges on the Rhine. Mm-hmm. You mentioned how much that trip could vary. Were food and water provided by the barge, or did you have to carry your own, or did they stop on shore? How did it work that?
Well, you were on your own, basically. You had to, many of the accounts talk about the immigrants running out of food, running out of water, running out of money. It was quite tough. I suspect that you could make almost any sort of deal for going down the line that you wanted to. Remember, these are fairly small barges and actually fairly cheap. You got 40, 60 immigrants. If they were in a group, trusted each other, some of them might even have purchased their own barge. Actually use their funds to purchase a barge to take them down the river, if intending to sell the barge, in Rotterdam and get the money back. You can think of all sorts of scenarios and deals that you could make. If you had a little money, you could make all sorts of deals. If you didn't have any money, if you're going to have to indent yourself, you were probably pretty dependent on whatever barge captain had a deal to deliver immigrants to a ship in Rotterdam.
What the cost would be in today's dollars for a trip like this?
Oh, I knew somebody was going to ask that. I worked it out at one time, and I wasn't able to find how I worked it out. The accounts that I have seen is that the trip down the Rhine, if you actually paid for it, cost about two-thirds of what it costs to go from Rotterdam to Charleston. Rotterdam to Charleston was 6 pistols of gold at the time. And what I can't remember is what 6 pistols of gold works out to that thing cost. It's a very complicated, it's not a simple calculation. And you get into the difference between exchange rates and actual coins, and it's a mess, and I can't remember how I worked it out.
What would the indenture agreements be like? Shows that?
No. Basically, the indenture agreement was you're going to be carried for free. And when you got to Charleston, you were sold off for the cost of your passage. And that could mean anywhere from 3 to 5 years of labor. So for those 3 to 5 years, you were a slave. Once you were freed, then you were just like everybody else. You could go collect your land, start your own life, and away you went. It's sort of interesting. One of my ancestors actually had an indentured servant. This servant was the namesake for Schilling's Bridge just outside of Orangeburg. But he was indentured to Henry Rickenbacker and ended up being the godfather for Henry Rickenbacker's children. And, you know, you would suspect that, you know, as an indentured servant, probably he would feel like just part of the family, likely living in the same house and everything.
I think there's a book, Uncommon Strangers. There's a book that someone in recent, the last 10 years or so, has published. It talks about this entire trade system. Mm-hmm. It talks about the agents. I found like the South Carolina Gazette listing when my ancestor's ship come in, and it had the company's name, and I kept wondering about, you know, they had to be some agents, you know, that's financing this kind of stuff. And this book talks about that.
Yes.
And it actually lists a lot of South Carolina ships that came into Charleston.
Right.
That's a really good discussion about the Dutch, the British government, or British powers to be and financiers of financing this getting the population, you know, boost over here. And it really is just a fascinating read. It's been on the web, but, you know, for the list, I'll send it around, but it's a good book.
Yeah, it's quite interesting how this whole trade worked out. And it changed over the years, because 1730 or so, it was early days of the trade. Peak trade years were like 1750 or so. And so, it changed over the years. Yes, you'll have to speak up back there.
For example, 1750.
Uh-huh.
How many ships in that year came across? Just round numbers.
Don't pin me down.
Three came into Charleston that year.
Yeah. My impression would be it would be maybe something like a dozen or so, including those to Philadelphia. Maybe more. But, you know, we're not talking hundreds. And we're probably not talking less than 10.
I'm curious, as part of your studies, Scotch-Irish, they took the same kind of route down North Africa and across the Antilles and perhaps into Philadelphia.
They sailed on a ship.
Pardon? I didn't catch that.
I'm sorry. Sorry, I was speaking loud. Scotch-Irish,
uh-huh.
Part of your studies, when they came out of England, Ireland, they kind of come down through North Africa on trade winds and come across in the Antilles, perhaps in Philadelphia or in South Carolina?
Yes, I was just giving the answer right here, because there was a sailing ship that did it. only with the advent of steam did, you know, they start coming directly across. But as long as there were sailing ships, they followed that. That's even the recommended route today if you're an amateur sailor and you want to sail your boat from Europe to America. That's the way they tell you to go. There are other ways you can try if you're an experienced sailor with a modern sailboat. But if you're not that experienced, the southern route is the one they tell you to take.
I don't know if this is in your category to ask you this question, but I was just wondering what might be the percentage of the first 5 years of people that came to the Orangeburg district who were from Germany and Switzerland? Because there were occasional other people and stuff.
I would say, from what I've seen, the vast majority would be Swiss and German. The Scotch-Irish came a little bit later.
Yeah, they went up. Well, they came down.
But, you know, the early years was primarily Swiss and German. Of course, there were others. And there were British subjects that came over. But, you know, the primary ones you find in the records, particularly for this area, are Swiss and German.
Jim? Just to add something here, if you see a name that doesn't look Swiss or German, you can be deceived. I spent years finding out about Hazelwoods, until I discovered they were actually Isenbuts from Appenzell Ausserhoven. And so the names would be misspelled, and sometimes they would flatly be anglicized.
Yeah.
So if you think you have an English name, you may not.
Yeah, just to add to that, the English name Peterly, which you find in the early records of Orangeburg County, is actually Swiss, and it's Bitterly, B-I-T-T-E-R-L-I. The B's and German B's and P's can almost not be distinguished, and Bitterly sounds like Peterly.
This might be outside your track, but when they committed to go to Orangeburg, I'm asking, you know, well, my gosh, if they gotten tired and stopped somewhere else, or did they start as a group? What is it about Orangeburg that was their destination from the other side of it?
Well, the British Council had set up several townships for immigrants. You know, there was Saxe-Gotha, there was Amelia, there was Orangeburg. And, you know, basically at this time they had none in them. Nobody was in them, except they had been laid out. And as I mentioned, when the Samuel arrived, the council suggested they wanted to go to Orangeburg. They said, we think Orangeburg is the most suitable for you. But the immigrants said, well, can we take a look at Amelia also? And the council said, okay, you may take a look at Amelia and Shoes. And, you know, practically speaking, they're fairly close together. You're going to go all the way by Amelia anyway. So they just took a look, and thankfully for us, they chose Orangeburg.
That Oberland route, is that kind of a Cherokee trail?
I'm not sure. But thinking about the Swamps River, you know, Margaret has got a nice drainage map out by her table, and she doesn't have the lower part of it. But if you look at the route that I described, it's quite easy to trace it out there and up Highway 6 and see how it avoids all the major drainages. You know, you stick to the high ground.
There's a good article in this month's Wildlife Magazine put out by the DNR on the Cherokee Trail.
Uh-huh.
And the history of it and pictures and so forth, maps.
Okay. Thanks. Anything else? I think it's time for our break.
Yeah, we're going to have a break now.
All right. I'll let you define the break.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.